I'll explain a little bit about the Zapatista organization and about a little bit about who they are. So most people know about the uprising in Chiapas on 1st January 1994, which was when the EZLN, which is sort of the guerrilla group that comes sort of with Zapatismo, took several municipalities in Chiapas. And it was really important for several reasons. First of all, because it changed a lot of... Well, first of all, it captured people's imagination. It captured people's imagination across the world, and it introduced something into sort of those movements, anti-capitalist movements, which was totally different. So it came from the indigenous people, and it was also reaching out globally. And they had their faces covered, so there wasn't really much individualism. But one of the important things about that uprising also was that they actually took land. So the EZLN took a lot of land. At the time, that was about 12% of the state of Chiapas. Mexico consists of federal states, so Chiapas is the southernmost one, it's the border to Guatemala. So 12% of the land of an entire state is quite a lot of land. And they've used that land for subsistence farming, for starting new communities, Zapatista communities, but also they've always used it to invite other people to it. So right from the start, from I think 1996 onward, they organized seminars and meetings where people from all over the world would come. Yeah. And that is one of the reasons why the Zapatistas later became a huge inspiration for lots of other parts of the anti-globalization movement and the outer-globalization movement. So theirs was really sort of an alternative vision of globalization, which was about global justice, and which was about decolonizing and about generally a totally different way of doing things and of perceiving of oneself in sort of in a context. And that's also why dispossession is such a big, it's such a dispossession and displacement, especially at the moment, are such an important theme, because having that land is very important not only for them, but also for everyone who's sort of connected to them, because they use that land as a base from which they can provide spaces for all the other movements that they're related to globally. So as soon as they, well, when they took the land, they first of all went into peace negotiations with the government, and then they reached an accord, and then the government implemented a very diluted version of that accord. And so the Zapatista communities refused to go along with that. So they said they would implement the accords, but on their own, unilaterally, so to speak. So that's what they've done really since 2001. And what that meant was that they implemented autonomy, basically. So they have their own forms of government, which is the good government councils. Their whole territory is divided in 5 regions, and each region has a council. And there's a complicated structure of assemblies that we can talk about more if you're interested, but where basically the people who are on these councils rotate, not all at the same time, sort of stacked so that there's no discontinuity, but so they rotate every 2 years, and the idea is that everybody at some point serves on those councils. And they have certain ethical rules on how those councils are to be run. And in addition to the councils, they also have their own education system. They have their own security system, their own justice system, and their own health system. And so in doing all that, they try to rely as little as possible on sort of anything that comes from the outside, but they will do so when they need to. So for example, with regards to the health system, yes, they've built it up in 3 parts. They have the bone setters, the people who are experts in plants and medicine, non-synthetic pharmacology, if you so wish, and women's health. Yeah. And so they will, for example, use pharmaceutical medication against diarrhea or serious illnesses like that. but they will only do it when they have no other way out. So for the most part, they try to work with the other abilities that they have. And the important thing about the Zapatista communities is that they work in that, they work according to these principles: freedom, democracy, justice, and dignity. And those principles are non-negotiable. And if somebody in Zapatista, in Chiapas wants to become a Zapatista, then that means that they have to sort of join one of those communities and live that kind of life. And if you don't want to do that, then in their thinking you're not a Zapatista, but you can be connected to the Zapatistas through the network of solidarity. And the way they did that, and sort of made that obvious, is in 2006. They issue declarations from time to time. So in 2006, they issued the sixth declaration of the Lacandon Jungle, where they basically made a resume and had a reflection about everything that they've done since. And what it is that could be achieved and how to get there. So it's not sort of a list of demands, we want this, 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 and that, but this is how we want to walk, as they put it. And those are the principles that guide us. And so then people or organizations or groups would sign the sixth declaration. And that is sort of, then you're in solidarity with the Zapatistas in the theater of Thailand. So the UK Zapatista Solidarity Network signed the sixth declaration. And the UK Zapatista Solidarity Network has different groups. There's one in Bristol, there's one in Edinburgh, there's one in London, there's one in Manchester. There's one in Dorset, and then there's lots of other, and then there's two other collectives. One is the Don Dorito Teaching and Learning Collective, which is kind of how we run the workshops, and the other one is the Translation Collective, through the translations. Yeah. And so basically all over the world, you have like little groups and collectives who try to work together in that spirit. Yeah, so you have Radio Zapatista, for example, who are in Chiapas, and they do Zapatista reporting. But they try to always provide it with Spanish and English where they can. So, or there's other group in the United States who we also work with, or groups in Europe. There's a European Zapatista network as well, where you have groups in different countries of Europe who meet every couple of years or work together in that spirit. But solidarity, that doesn't mean charity. It doesn't mean that we ship stuff there. And when money is needed, then we might also have fundraisers. But for the most part, it's about changing according to those principles in your calendar and your geography, as they call it. And so a lot of it is about time and work and energy rather than money. And so basically that's a bit of the background, very briefly.
Just to get an idea of scale in Chiapas, the numbers of Zapatistas.
Nobody knows, okay. And that is partially to protect them, because the government and the transnational corporations have waged a really cruel war against them. Sometimes that was open, like a military encounters, but what it's become recently is more and more sort of hidden war, counterinsurgency war, which means that, for example, the government won't send in the troops, yeah, or the transnational corporations won't send in a private security service, but they will sort of pay other communities who also live on Zapatista territory to harass the Zapatistas. And last year, in May last year, that led to a very spectacular and cruel murder of one of the Zapatistas, a member of the Sotel. So that's also related to dispossession, but that's also why it's very useful if nobody knows exactly how many there are. The only thing that we do know is in 2001, they did a huge silent march through Chiapas. And I think about 55,000 of them came, which meant that those were the people who could walk, who were fit, who came down from the mountains. So you have to multiply that several times, because there's probably lots more who couldn't come. So it's in Chiapas, it is a lot of people, And globally, it is actually quite big. It's quite a big network. Does that answer
you?
Yes.
Yeah,
just don't hesitate to interrupt. So yeah, it's important to keep in mind sort of the way in which lots of different people, yeah, the Mexican government, and transnational corporations are trying to pressure and basically do away with Zapatismo. But the Zapatistas also have such a big network across the world that it would be very difficult to sort of attack them directly and just burn them to the ground. Yeah. So they try to do it through these hidden tactics, which is very wearing, very draining. And as the case of the Pompeo was killed shows, it can be difficult. All that takes place in Mexico, of course, in the context of at the moment of a very repressive government that uses the so-called supposed war on drugs in order to pressure, incarcerate, kill, disappear, torture members of social movements. So in Mexico, it's a very, very difficult situation. Interestingly, one of the areas where the drug cartels don't really have any foothold is Zapatista territory. So that's sort of a bit of background in terms of what's happened recently, also with regards to displacement and dispossession. There have been a couple of cases which are really famous. One is San Sebastián Bachajón. I don't know if anyone's heard about that. It's a community which has signed the Sixth Declaration. They aren't Zapatistas, but they've signed the Sixth Declaration, and they work very closely with the Isabelan and the communities in Chiapas. They live very close to some very beautiful waterfalls, and there's plans to develop those waterfalls into an ecotourist resort. That is part of a bigger plan to develop the whole Mayan coast as touristically. So it's part of a whole rhetoric, really, of development and progress. And that community, San Sebastián Bachajón, has opposed that tourism project, because they say if there's any tourism at all at the waterfalls, then it should be run by the community, and it should benefit the community, and it should not be a corporation, and it should not be some sort of elitist eco project. Like, if you watch the videos on what this is supposed to look like, the videos themselves are there, classes, they're racist, they're and you can tell that this is catering towards people with money. So on those grounds, they've opposed that. I think two members of the community have been killed so far. One of them was one of their spokespeople who was killed last year. And so they had a court case against that tourism project, which they lost now. So they are probably going to need a lot of further sort of support for their resistance. Now, one can do that by signing declarations and so on, but importantly, it's also it's important to sort of work on a worldwide scale to work against that logic of progress. Of progress which can't do without dispossession, because effectively that community, that's a threat of dispossession against their land, but also against, in a way, their relationship to their environment. And another case which was very important was the community of Banavil. Those were some Zapatista families who were displaced. They actually had to leave their community. They now live in San Cristóbal de las Casas, and what that means is they're basically subsistence farmers. Yeah. So when they're displaced and they have to live in the city, that means they have to sell their labor. It's meant impoverishment for some of them. And they are, of course, terribly homesick. They want to go home. Yeah. But so it's basically these two things which are going on there. On the one hand, just forceful displacement, the forced displacement of the communities, but also the dispossession. Yeah, that sense of, in a way, they can stay there, but they have no control. They have they can't do anything with the land that they live on. And the other thing that's been reported widely are the students in Ayutthaya Napa, the 43 teacher students who were disappeared. Now that is something that we really have to see in the context of education and the privatization of education. Those teacher students were from a school which takes an approach which is about the education of very remote, very often indigenous, often very, very poor, very deprived areas of the country. So it's also a way of using education to empower these particular communities. And the fact that those teacher colleges have been targeted for years by the government. And this is
in... It's in another state of
it's
Mexico.
In Guerrero.
It's not Chiapas, but no. It's another state.
They've been targeted for that, so we have to see that in that context. It's not just that a few people wanted to do away with those 43 students. Like, that was an attack on like anyone who opposes sort of the elitism and the privatization of education. And the Zapatistas, the Isetailen, have sort of in mutual solidarity with each other. Yeah, so they went to see the Isetailen, and the Isetailen and the Zapatista communities have supported them. And the other thing is, like, recently, just last week, the Zapatistas did one of those events where they invited everybody, which was a seminar on critical thinking. So they invited a bunch of people to give presentations and papers, but also they themselves gave presentations and papers, which was a way of trying to connect experiential knowledge and analytical knowledge. They have this maxim, analyze, debate, organize. So the seminar for critical thinking was part of that. It's one example of how they use their space for other people as well. So, obviously there would be lots more to say, but just to sort of give a bit of background. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of pressure, but there's also a lot of resistance, and there's a lot of sort of good spirit and positive thinking.
You said there was a silent march. I'm just wondering what form the resistance takes generally. Is it diplomatic resistance, or is it action?
Well, building the autonomy in itself is already an act of resistance.
Yes.
But then they have this thing where sometimes for long periods of time they go into silence. Because they say listening is just as important as talking. And when you're there, there are people who measure their words very carefully. They speak when they have something to say, but they also spend a lot of time in silence. Which is also something for contemplation, for connecting on different levels, which might be more, which might not be verbal. So the silent march was about that. You can watch it on YouTube. There's images of it. It's very impressive. They all wore masks. The other words, ski masks. And they were marching through these communities. And in San Cristóbal de las Casas, in front of the cathedral, they had like a little,
stage.
Yeah, it looked kind of like a mini stage, something like that. And because they have this thing of not having any protagonists, they all walked across it. And as they walked across it, they all looked down. Yeah? And they said later on in the communique that was because you don't look up. You don't look up to those who's above you. You look down to what's going on the ground and to those who are sort of below. Like, that's where you got a gaze, where you take your orientation from. So I don't know, if we talk a bit more about dispossession, then we can...
What we are thinking to do is, because the term, they sometimes call it the four wheels of capitalism, which are dispossession, disdain, exploitation, and repression. We are thinking to this as a theme and to explore more specifically dispossession. And we wanted to open up a kind of discussion here, both with what is dispossession and what dispossession means to us, those who live here in prison in England, and kind of what kind of relevance can have with the Zapatistas' experience, but also more important for our experience that we are facing, understanding dispossession. Maybe we heard what might be dispossession for this community section. Their land taken off. But maybe there are other type of dispossession that are still quite relevant to us. We were thinking to work in pairs, but perhaps
maybe we could do all together.
Because it's quite a small group, perhaps we can open up the discussion between our staff rather than dividing our staff in smaller groups.
Yeah, and we were the four views of capitalism when they work together. Yeah, you have disdain, which can be like the disdain for whole populations, which is sort of brought about by propaganda machines or by laws or whatever, and then that justifies them being pushed out. Out of whatever territory or wherever they live. And then you have repression, which is when somebody resists, then they are repressed violently. Exploitation, in a way, is sometimes you can, well, for example, you can weaken people through exploitation. So for us, for example, it could be like urban space, like in a way, public spaces. Like in our geography and our calendar, now for us cities were always very important, also for resistance, and for lots of different people coming together. Let's say in Europe, right? So when we're dispossessed of the public spaces, yeah, when they are organized in such a way that we can't use them anymore, in a way that is also forms of dispossession. Of it. Education could be dispossession, where education tries to in a way dispossess you of your own capacities and put them into somebody else's mold or model. So
we were talking about the other day how dispossession of a communal space in an urban area like Manchester is quite visible, especially when you want to try to make some political statement. Personally, for instance, I remember when there was an Occupy movement in Occupy Manchester. We tried to set up a stall spontaneously in Upper Square, which is the square just in front of the town hall, simply to discover that what we thought was a public space was actually rented out to private companies, whom in turn they were renting out to all the stalls, the kind of Christmas and market stalls, and then employing private security to enforce this type of a privatization of a public space. And then we had difficulties in kind of setting up spontaneously without asking our stall to distribute material. We were kind of pushed on the side. And I don't know if you think about this possession, if there's any relevance.
I can relate to the public space debate. I come from an architecture, urban planning background. There's kind of two types of ways that people are kind of marginalized from public space, I think. One is actively for example, in Bristol, the new city centre is part of it is policed daily, constantly. There are no actively kind of moving on homeless people, or you're not allowed to smoke, or do this, that, and the other. And that's a very kind of forceful way of dispossessing people from their city, I suppose. But other ways, it's more kind of subtle in that if you focus public spaces around particularly commercial entities rather than civic entities, then the kind of ownership of that space changes a lot, and the type of person that is able to or welcome is kind of dictated by the by whatever kind of usually kind of commercial kind of establishments surround it. You surround public space with high-end stores, then it's unwelcoming to people who feel that they are unable to afford whatever's inside it. That's my experience of it.
I was just going to say, I think you're right about the dispossession in our society, and the public spaces, and education, everything else. There is a dispossession. And we still have the original dispossession as well, of course, the dispossession of the land. Sometimes I think we're so far away from that, we sort of lost touch with it. And we don't even know that we haven't got any land. There's nobody in living memory. There is nobody. My ancestors would have been chucked off the thrown off the countryside hundreds of years ago. Hundreds of years of living in towns and not having a direct contact with our food and so on. We're very distanced from that. Right? And it seems that it's much harder to talk to people about that in this country, Western capitalist countries, because it's so distant, so far away from people's minds that it could be possible that the land isn't owned by anyone, that it's owned community where the community is, and that you wouldn't have to pay rent just to exist, go to the supermarket to buy your food. There's a huge gulf between that sort of existence.
Is it like a dispossession of history?
Yeah, that's another level, isn't it? Yeah.
Is it just, you said dispossession of land, and I immediately thought of land ownership. It's the way that you speak about land is your ownership. If you're talking about that, that's the very notion of ownership being. It's kind of dispossessing in itself to enforce ownership of the land, which is the truth about. Being dispossessed from the earth.
You're right. I was just thinking, forcing people out of the land, even if it happened 100 years ago, still means that we, as people, as persons, we don't have any access to means of subsistence. And so we are forced actually to sell our labor in the labor market. We don't have any other way around it. It's far away history, but it is repeated through generation because it leaves fewer choices than to go to the institutional route of capitalism, which is you are free, but you're only free to sell your labor power and be happy with it if someone wants to.
I think an extension of dispossession of the land is dispossession of knowledge of food production and what goes into our food and the fact that we have to buy food and it's manufactured and it's often grown in laboratories. Yet McDonald's, and it still portrays that image that everything is, you know, animals live on a farm rather than in industrial feedlots. And so it's that dispossession of the knowledge of what really goes on. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in ways. Yeah, not only also food itself, but also to eat, isn't it? Like, which is something quite fundamental, really, in human. Sort of what you ingest, in a way.
It's the process, isn't it? Yeah. Mm. The process of growing, eating, growing yourself. It's, everything's assumed that it's kind of happening right now, I suppose. That there hasn't been a long process of growing whatever it is we're eating, or farming whatever it is we're eating, in order to get it into a fate.
How would it be? Could we say how it happens? It's much through a physical taking away and removal from people. This possession happens in some way through the physical removal or exclusion of people.
Initially.
Yeah. But then there's also something about closing down and what you said about.
Well, I think now, yes. I think it's incredibly difficult to break out of any kind of thinking and become possessed in some way.
Yes, it's almost like an ideology, like we've been dispossessed from any kind of culture of resistance or framing things as any way of difference, like even thinking in alternative ways, but we have to use the word alternative to imply the difference between anything has been lost and anything that is now. It's just complete detachment from any potential of difference.
Yeah, it's also increasingly, as I was trying to say, it's increasingly difficult to be kind of repossess yourself with, for example, the production of food. It's incredibly difficult when you live in Sheffield, for example, to be in control of everything that you're eating, from growing it to consuming it. It's not just difficult, it's impossible for everyone to do it.
This is really the land.
Yes.
Maybe some of that is also about relationships of trust, because you can't grow your own food, but maybe you can do something else. But then, if you have people who you can trust, that they sort of take care of food well, then you can still do whatever it is that you can contribute. And it's that relationship of trust. You can't trust a supermarket.
Mm. This is where everything's pushed towards, and small agricultural places, small farmers, and the production from farmers is better. Through price competition, they force them to adopt some of the technique of big agribusiness. Very indirect dispossession. The autonomy or connection with people who could have the capability of producing healthy or local or genuine food, rather than using the method of the big agribusiness.
I mean, there's an inevitability about growing populations, and they do need feed. Finding ethical ways of producing a lot of food is, I suppose, the challenge.
I put them in what is what people are being dispossessed of is the body. I work a lot with fairly young adults, and in a way, I think some of it is about sort of feeling yourself. Like you were saying about feeling yourself as sort of an integral creature that breathes and eats and interacts socially and all of that. But there is also something about body and about body image and being looked at and that desire to be looked at, which is being judged all the time. Which in a way, I think many people don't feel anymore that they actually inhabit their body. Like that it's theirs, it's what other people see. Which sort of puts you out of sync with being objective.
I think you're right. There's kind of two things at play. One is the image of the body as a mechanical thing, as a medical thing, and the image of the body as other people see it, which is a kind of imaginary thing. But I don't think we consider our bodies as in an imaginary way. Quite objective way.
I suppose that ties in again, you know, how dispossession of the body, you know, into knowledge production and how bodies and people are portrayed in magazines and in the media. With our clothes horses for the fashion industry, really, or other means of selling things rather than as people sort of being taken away from this.
What you just said, in a way, that was also about understanding, wasn't it? About the way we understand.
No, I was just saying, on a personal level, comparing my personal experience to someone in the Zapatista community who is being directly dispossessed from their land and therefore from means of subsistence. In my case, will be different. But then I was thinking the way dispossession, I can feel kind of connection, is that to me, capitalism enforces changes on technology, but not only on technology and on way of producing and doing things as well. Also on the way we relate to each other in order to do things, which changes quite rapidly in a way that what my parents knew in their jobs, nothing of that could have been transmitted to me in a way that was going to be useful. So I had to have a different life trajectory. Really, kind of, again, to find my own way to access some means of subsistence, which was not, couldn't be helped, let's say, from previous generations. So that's what, in the end, for example, in my case, I had to change country from Italy to England to make it. So, in a way, these are also sad. Had these type of changes had a real displacement and dispossession. So yeah, this is how I think another way dispossession have a similar effect perhaps admittedly, perhaps it's more dramatic in Chiapas. So.
Well, I think some of it is also about how you subsist as a human being. You know, like what you were saying. Like I thought, like for me, for example, like my family has lived in industrial cities ever since we can remember. Right? We can go back until the 19th century, but we've always lived in industrial cities. And in a way, the way we've survived and the way we've thrived as much as we could was through the mind, through the imagination, through social contexts, being in a social context, interacting with other people, building something together. And those are precious. Those are precious things as well. Work, not as paid labor, but work as being creative, not in that neoliberal way, but creating things. So there is something about how people think of themselves and what makes them themselves. Obviously, someone in Chiapas would think about that very differently than we do. But then again, there's maybe something like care. Or a passion or principles with the way in which you think about that and the way in which you feel that. Which leads me. For example, in Chiapas, what they did to build up the health system in terms of passing on skills, they went through all the different communities and convinced all the people who had any knowledge of any of this, plus lots of solidarity people who came from outside, to teach others. Yeah, so they actually built up this enormous corpus of medical knowledge, which had been dispersed across the different communities. It took them years to do it, and they're still at it, but they did it. Now, by talking to all these different peoples and then people agreed that this was a worthwhile project. But it took them years, and that's something else. It takes years.
And what kind of technology do they have for collating this information? How does it exist? How is it shared?
I think a lot of it they write down. I haven't seen it but a lot of it they do write down, and they have a lot of meetings where they pass that on oral and they train it to each other. So each community, they select somebody or several people who then will become health workers. And then they get sent to wherever it is that they have to go in order to learn these things. And then the idea is that they again pass it on to others. And the same, like what I have seen is their school books, some of their school books, which each of them, they make them, right? And a lot of that is about history and about recovering history and not thinking about history as linear. But for example, one image I saw was thinking of history as a tree, or thinking of history as a river. And the tree has like different branches and leaves, and then different events and processes are written into the tree. I mean, that was a school book for young children. But so that's kind of the way in which I do that. It is kept, but they're also, they don't always say how they do it. So we've had quite a lot. I wrote just down things: public space, history, language, knowledge. Understanding the body, work, and also how it's done, because it's really quite complex. It works like in many different ways, doesn't it? Physical removal, the language speaking, sometimes the language in which we think, disinformation, lack of information, discouraging inquisitiveness, detachment from the potential of difference, coercion, disdain, and in a way, it's probably good stuff to take back to wherever we're going to go, to wherever we're going to go next. Now, what we so we hope you do this. Like we hope you will do this and take them back. If you want to stay in touch with us, we have the an email list there, sign up for the email list for the Manchester Zapatistas. Manchester Zapatistas send an email once, maximum two a month, because we don't want to fragment people's attention span. So there's the email list. There's a leaflet which has lots of websites and contacts for the different Zapatista groups in the UK on it. It looks a bit old, but that's because we're making a new one at the moment. The important thing are the contacts, and those are there. We brought a few books if you wanted to buy any of those. Football Through Freedom, that's about a football team in Bristol who works with the combat in Chiapas through football. And Beyond Resistance is an interview with the Sukwana de Marcos, who is no longer the Sukwana de Marcos. He was one of the commanders of the Zapatistas. Well, he's no longer there, but much of what he says still stands. And we also have a CD of Zapatista music, which you can also buy, and you can also listen to it if you first want to have a listen before you buy it. And Freedom, the football book, costs £10, and the other one costs £5. And if you can think of any groups who would like to have those workshops, get in touch with us through the Manchester Zapatistas. And have a look on the UK Zapatista website at the Sixth Declaration. Think about if that's something you can take to wherever you're going and do something with it. You will also see that it's written very differently in terms of the language.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming.